We're all beginning to feel it. We're being watched. We browse online for a wallet or a toaster or a bicycle. We don't even buy it. We just hover on the page for a second. Sure enough, 2 minutes later, an ad for that exact product appears on our Facebook page or in the middle of an article we're reading. We all know that we're being watched. So who's doing the watching? How exactly do they do it? Are the people who are watching us all day, every day, actually making our world a better place? Do the watchers care about us, or are they simply selling us to the highest bidder? That's up next on The Q Factor. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to The Q Factor. I'm Greg Fisher. My guest today is truly a fascinating man. And yes, he's one of the people whose job it is to watch you. But don't get creeped out just yet. Instead, I'd invite you to use this conversation to get informed about the way that our data is being used by some of the smartest people in the world to measure just about everything we do. Understanding this kind of quantitative thinking, how the moves we make, the people we interact with, and the products we buy are all being tracked, bought, and sold. Understanding this is exactly why I launched The Q Factor. The people being paid to watch you, like my guest today, aren't necessarily bad, but they are without question the way of the future, and even the present. My guest's name is Afshin Gudarzi. He is the chief analyst at a company called 1010 Data, a company that specializes in being the quantitative eyes and ears for other companies. 1010 Data's clients include enormous multinationals like JP Morgan, Procter & Gamble, and Coca-Cola. In other words, the Coca-Colas of the world pay 1010 Data to better understand exactly how their customers and potential customers live and breathe. Afshin is truly a lovely man, brilliant, ethical, and a pleasure to be around. You'll see in the beginning of our conversation, we talk about our mutual love of music. But Afshin is also holding the privacy of millions of people like you in the palm of his hand. Afshin knows full well that the phone in your pocket is essentially a homing device, sending your whereabouts out into the world every second of every day for companies like 1010 Data to buy and sell. Afshin lives not only in the bleeding edge of the information age, but on an ethical razor's edge as well. Here's our conversation. Afshin, thanks for coming on The Q Factor today. I really appreciate it. So we have to begin with our common interest in music. You know, we're here in my studio that I built a few years ago, which is actually in the basement of my home, totally soundproofed with all these instruments. And you and I got together this morning, and the first thing you said to me is, I should have guessed it that you were a musician. I said, oh, why? Are you a musician? And I am finding that it does seem like a lot of people that are into quantitative methods and math gravitate to music. I don't know if you found the same connection, but let's talk about music for a couple of minutes before we jump into the content.
Sure. People say right brain, left brain. I just think of a singular brain. I think of it as there is a lot of interests that that people have. I'm very interested in music, and the first time I listened to this beautiful rendition of a piece of Iranian classical music, I was so moved, I decided I am definitely going to learn how to do this, and that was when I was in my late 20s.
How important do you think it is when you're putting music together, for example, that you have the answer to the question before you start? That you know what you want this to sound like, and then you sort of go back and make it sound that way? Or how much of it do you think is just this exploration, the unknown, when we all get together and start jamming?
Iranian classical music is purely improvisatory in its original tradition. So it's all about exploration. It's completely open to you interpreting the language, the iconic sort of phrasing that is there, taking all of that and exploring it in your way, in your interpretation is really yours. It's completely open to you doing whatever you need to do. Now, there's structure, there are rules. So if you walk in, and we do this with data all the time, we do this with music all the time, you walk in with a bias. You walk in with a story that you wish to tell. If you walk in with a bias and a story that you wish to tell, the music will relent. So will the data.
That's great. Right.
The data will tell you whatever story you want it to tell.
Earlier in your career, you had worked at Equifax. mm-hmm. and thinking about mortgages and that financial crisis. And, sure. you know, I think there are, I wrote my client letter recently and mentioned how I think we're currently at a point, you know, globally where there's more debt globally than there has been ever in the history of the data. I think we're running at something like 300% of global GDP in global debt. Mm-hmm. And I think back to 2009 when you were at Equifax, is there something that went on back then, now looking back at it 10 years later, where if we were using data the way we are today, that maybe we could have predicted that would have happened better, there would have been some early warning signs? What did you learn from that?
There were early warning signs. A lot of people talked about them. In fact, a lot of folks that shorted the market ended up making a killing.
Well, there weren't too many, but there were a few. what data were they looking at?
Well, they were looking at a lot of different data, but it was also the way that they phrased the question. So the couple of examples that I know of are cases where people were asking, is the growth of house prices sustainable as it is right now? Forget about the mortgage market in and of itself. We're betting, basically the fundamental bet was that the prices are going to continue to rise the way they have been. And that fundamental bet just doesn't work, right?
So yeah, the idea is that it was going to grow forever.
Forever, exactly. Right. And that bet doesn't work. So some folks stood up. I don't know if I should mention names.
No problem.
Some folks stood up and said, no, this is not a good idea. We're not going to do that. We're going to analyze the data a different way, and we're going to come to a different conclusion. Because the way we're phrasing the question is it possible that these prices are going to go up forever? Whereas others were posting the question a completely different way. They were saying, can I walk away from making money in the next 6 months? That was a different question from, is it possible to continue to observe a rising market this way? Those are two different questions, two different results, and net, the data was pretty much the same. It was just the way that the question was raised that yielded completely different action.
I've been reading a lot lately, particularly, you know, China announced in 2030 it wants to be the world's dominator in artificial intelligence. And I think many of us think they'll probably do that because of the amount of data they already have and will have, just given the way they protect privacy a little differently than we do in the U.S. Then I was reading about this new financial services company, relatively new in China, Ant Financial, mm-hmm. Owned by Alibaba. I think they launched in 2004, and they now have twice the market cap of Goldman Sachs. And they're doing things like, you know, this social scoring. You know, if you cross the street weird, you get a negative point. If you, you know, say something negative, honk your horn. If you go to the bathroom too many times a day, and or whatever. They're looking at all this data so that when you show up to apply for a mortgage mm-hmm. or to borrow money or to start a business, within seconds they know whether they should give you the money or not. And I think there's some other companies. I met another person here in the U.S. doing something similar to analyze using data. Is data like that available? You know, for example, how many times you leave your home and go to Starbucks, or how many times you leave your home and go to the supermarket, or how fast you might be driving? Is that type of data available?
It is. It is, because what you're monitoring is basically cell phone movement. So you're looking at a device and looking at how that device is moving through space. So you can see at 8 a.m. where I am and 30 seconds later where I am and so on. If I'm driving in a particular brand of car, and I won't mention their brand, but if I'm driving around in a particular brand of car, you can actually track the vehicle. And you can see exactly where the vehicle is at every point in time. If you could do that, then that data is analyzable and you can figure out that, hey, this guy gets up in the morning, goes to the train station, and then hops the train and then goes. So you can start to stitch together an entire routine for every single person using all of the data that is available today. The question is whether or not, by virtue of using those data elements, you start to at least legally and at most ethically start to invade people's privacy.
Yes, very
and
sensitive topic.
Those are like the Amazon example, the Facebook example, where they're doing facial recognition and facial recognition is failing them. it's bias. And this is where the statement of the problem really, really matters. So when you start coming into a question, how you state the problem sort of helps you figure out what kind of data you collect and then ultimately how you answer the question.
Back to 1010 Data and its original mission. I know that your founders, Joel Kaplan and Sandy Steyer, I think they more or less pioneered the idea of what we now call the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around the year 2000. I mean, nobody was talking about the cloud in the year 2000.
Sure.
Unless it was a rainy day. And 10 years before that term really became mainstream, they were using it. So tell us a little bit more about Joel and Sandy and, you know, what they were doing before they landed this big idea and what was the motivation behind them forming 1010 Data?
So I think of Joel and Sandy as brilliant individuals in the following way. They saw a need. They were analyzing data for the financial industry. They were in the equities world, and they were analyzing very large volumes of data for the time. And they were frustrated that a lot of the questions that they wanted to be able to answer were hard to answer in the context of the tools that they had available to them. So they started working on solving this problem and analyzing it, analyzing the large volumes of data very, very fast. Huh. And they realized, if I can analyze it this fast, maybe other people have the same need and they want to be able to analyze the same kind of data as fast as we are. So they went off, started this company, and they were like any other little startup with a couple of people and
sure.
lots of sweat, lots of
I've
blood.
Been there.
So they were working it through, and unfortunately 9/11 happens. Mm. And the New York Stock Exchange reaches out, and they were in the middle of conversations about what they could do for them and so on. And they said, if you can stand this up really quickly, we can give you all the bid and quote data, and you can publish basically a book that was getting printed on a daily basis. Instead, you would have it online and you would be able to analyze it and read through it for all the traders that needed it.
So the New York Stock Exchange reaches out to them after 9/11.
So they were in conversations already, and they said, we need you to stand this up. You say you can do this. Can you stand it up? And famously, they stand up the database in a couple of days.
Wow!
And
what was the database doing? What was it they were at, for our listeners? What were they actually doing?
Every single transaction on the New York Stock Exchange, every bid and every quote.
Wow!
And we maintained this data, starting in the full data that was being maintained without interruption from 2003 all the way to the present. Was at its peak around 2 trillion rows of data, which is remarkable for a single table to have 2 trillion rows of data.
Particularly in the year 2001 or 2 or whatever.
Well, back then it wasn't that big. It grew over time.
Okay.
But certainly the foundation that Sandy and Joel laid was to be able to accommodate the large volumes of data and then to be able to process it.
Thinking about more examples of how data such as the data that your company provides and organizes can be useful, there's a research paper that I'm working on right now with my co-authors and colleagues, Eva Steiner from Cornell, Sheridan Tittman from Austin, Texas, and my colleague Ashvin Viswanathan from Gerstein Fisher, my firm.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on this research paper. I manage a REIT portfolio, publicly traded real estate all over the world. And I guess for decades, we've all thought about real estate as, you know, location, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the old days, people who were buying real estate, they'd have to sort of travel around the world and add up the rent rolls and review leases and
right.
think about all these things and, you know, watch people coming in and out of the building and, again, stand there with a clicker. And so the question that we're trying to answer in this research paper is one that I think we all feel we know the answer to, but it's not been looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with the relationship between population density
mm-hmm.
and the betas or volatility or risk of the real estate prices in those areas.
Mm.
Now, to do this, we need census data. We need to know where people are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, census data tells you where people live. So our hypothesis is that, and what seems to be proving out in the data, is that real estate that's held in highly dense areas is more volatile than real estate that isn't, because the supply and demand can, you know, is somewhat inelastic. It's hard to add a lot of property or remove a lot of property quickly in like urban dense areas, but population can change. So at any rate, we're looking at that relationship, and census data in the US, for example, I think it's updated every 10 years. So that wasn't that great. Then I went out and I looked at IRS data. You know, there's data out there publicly available about how many tax returns are filed, where people live, what their AGIs are. So we're looking at that. We're trying to do this internationally. So I was thinking, well, is there some other information like this stuff on iPhones, geo-tracking, you know, where people are, not only where they live, but where they work and how often are they there? Can you think of a way that I could better analyze the density of areas and the movement of people globally? Is there such a – is that data available yet?
So globally is tougher, but certainly in the U.S., we have a data set for over 100 million people where we look at where they are on a very frequent basis. So the raw data actually observes the person down to every 10 seconds, 30 seconds, depending on the device that they're carrying and what they're doing. So you could be observing people, movement of people, at a very granular level on a daily basis. So you could do that, and you can use that for the analysis that you're talking about. You would probably have to summarize it enough so that it makes sense. I don't think you want it per, you know, every 10 seconds or what have you. I think it's much more interesting if you, for an application that you're talking about, it's probably much more interesting to talk about it beginning of day, end of day, just so that you have a sense of where people are working and where people are living, so you can start to have that. You also probably want to see, depending on what's in the REIT, if you're observing malls, for example, you probably want to see how many people are walking into the malls, how many people are purchasing at the malls, and how many people are leaving. So the health of the mall, the operating company for the mall, is going to be a function of the foot traffic that they get, also the a function of all the purchases that are being made. It's also a function of store closings and store openings. So those are also indicators of the kinds of things that that you're talking about. So I think there are data sources that we have that would help. So examples are the mall is definitely something that we can help. There are the other two data sets that I mentioned are also very valuable in making the analysis a little bit simpler. Internationally, it's a much harder thing. In Europe, it is much more difficult than the U.S. And in the Far East, it's much easier to collect that data, but it's harder to gain access to it. The data is being collected in China. We know that. What we don't know is how to gain access to it, because a lot of the companies that are there are very, very protective of the data because they understand
how useful
it could be.
We all in the investment business have tortured this data so many times, but we've been looking at things like the price to sales, right? So you look at the market price, which you can observe every second of the day of any stock, and you put sales in the denominator and you compare all stocks across one another. What are their sales? What are their prices? And if you're a value investor and you believe that companies that trade on, you know, their prices are low relative to their sales when compared to all the others, that might be a portfolio you'd consider owning because they're sort of value stocks. Some people use earnings, some people use sales, a combination of the two. So things like sales, we used to have to wait, you know, a month, 2 months to the end of the quarter before the company would tell us what sales are.
Now you can look at it daily.
Right. So if I'm thinking, should I buy Uber or Lyft? They're both two publicly traded companies,
right,
or, you know, Netflix or, you know, Blockbuster back then, and or, you know, Apple or Amazon. Can we know what their sales are every day?
Not their total sales, but certainly on the samples that are available out there. So the sample that we have, which is several million people, you can observe how much sales Uber and how much sales Lyft has on a particular day. So that you can definitely look at. And then when you seasonally adjust that and you look at sort of the growth path that they're riding on, you can start to see, have they plateaued? Is this a market that's sort of drying up for them? Is that other market sort of picking up right now? You can start to look at their domestic activity mostly, because that's the data that we have. And you can start to sort of actually assess how well our numbers line up with historical numbers. So you can see that. And if it's lining up, which in most cases it lines up very nicely, then you can start to say, all right, I can rely on this data on a day-to-day basis.
It's well known, lots of case studies written on this, taught at many universities, about how if you treat your employees well, your company is likely to perform better than if you don't. And I think there were some like really weak methods of analyzing this in the past, you know, like surveys and things. But now there's all this data out there about how people feel about the places they work. I know Glassdoor is an example of that, but there's others. I had a person, I read a paper that he had done recently where he's analyzing the quality of the coffee that companies were serving to determine how well they were treating their employees. But ultimately to be able to, you know, come out and say, look, here's the data. You know, here are 10 ways we can measure how well employees are being treated in their businesses, and here's how that stock performed versus those that didn't, or something like that. You know, to be able to point to these things and, you know, hopefully drive behaviors that are good for many other reasons is exciting as well.
This is gaining a lot of traction right now. People are stopping the classical, I shouldn't say stopping, but there is less of a focus on a singular metric about the company, just sales or just revenues or what have you, and more about the entire portfolio of metrics that they can gain access to. And if you're interested in an investment that in a company that treats their employees well and does something good for the environment and does something good for society as a whole and so on, those metrics are being measured. For example, people are looking at the total distance in pay, in annual pay between the CEO and the lowest paid individual in the company. So the highest and the lowest paid, if there is a millionfold difference versus if there is a 10,000-fold difference, and they're measuring these and they're saying, okay, on this scale, so it's completely sort of on this scale, this company does better than this other company. And because we can measure this, we can then tell you that by our metric, you guys are better and you guys are worse. That's a very nice way of providing additional information to the world so that if somebody's interested in responsible, whatever responsible means,
sure,
then they can pick and choose the metrics they're interested in. What is really difficult is to make the argument that we can accurately measure enough of this to truly assess something about how moral a company is, how immoral a company is, how fair they are or how unfair they are. Those are softer notions that require data, certainly, but they also require a fair amount of judgment. And I think that makes it a much more difficult conversation. But it's an exciting moment because people are starting to ask this question. This is a good question.
It is. And bringing the crowd to those problems, you know, the wisdom of the crowd, more people shining the light on these issues, more people paying attention, particularly now with the popularity of indexing.
Right.
You know, even Jack Bogle, who really pioneered indexing, right before he passed away in November of this past year, he was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, I don't know if we're at 20, 30, 40, 50% indexed on the planet yet, but we're getting close. We're approaching 50. We're heading in that direction.
Yeah.
And the more of this sort of automated buying that happens, one of the problems that he illustrated in this quote was about corporate governance and how like people might be paying less attention to what companies are doing because of the popularity of indexing. So this kind of data and shining the light on these things could potentially bring more energy to those issues and have people vote on what they buy and not buy based on other factors other than just, you know, stock prices and returns and market capitalizations.
The voting is happening more aggressively than might meet the eye because universities, for example, have endowments that invest in all sorts of things. The kids in those schools are basically getting up and saying, I don't want you to invest there. I want you to invest over here. And I don't want your money in the hands of this financial institution because they don't treat their employees well. This other financial institution is better, or change it, or come up with another formula where your investments are not as, in their words, dubious as as what we would like. This voting is taking place actively right now. Whether or not the person that is voting is actually aware of all the metrics, all the analysis, all the different ways of looking at the data, they're still getting up and voting.
Yes.
So this is actively part of our social conversation right now. We're not going to get away from it. The question is, you know, if you're an investor, how do you learn where this data is coming from? How do you analyze this data? And then how do you make this data part and parcel of your decision-making process? That's our reality. We have to sort of contend with that.
Well, Afshin, thank you so much for coming on the Q Factor. I found this conversation fascinating. I'm really enjoying it. Obviously, it's real close to what my day-to-day life is like. I really appreciate you making the time. I have one final thing that we like to do as a tradition on the Q Factor, and we call them the three Qs. So these are the three questions we ask every guest, no matter what their background or expertise. And the first one is, in what field or sector do you see big data having the biggest positive impact on the world over the next 10 years? Now, it could be anything, science, manufacturing, investing, healthcare, climate change, you name it. Over the next decade, where and how will big data help the world the most?
It's not clear that one could give a definitive answer to that question. I can tell you what my favorite areas are to invest time and effort into. I think healthcare is thoroughly underserved with big data. The volume of data that is available for healthcare, for clinical analysis, is small, meaning the researchers don't have access to the data. The data is available, but the researchers don't have access to it, and they can't analyze the data. This, to me, is borderline criminal. This is incredible amounts of data that can help healthcare on a planetary scale. We can solve fundamental problems of human health if we start to look at much bigger volumes of data. Now, it is not enough to have one data set or another data set. What you really need is a concerted effort that starts to bring all of this together in one place and starts to figure out what the mechanisms are that will allow researchers, clinical researchers, to gain access to this data without impeding on people's privacy rights. So we don't want to impinge on that. What we want to do is we want to make it possible to do a lot more analysis at a much faster pace. The data is out there. There is enough data. It is just not organized. It is not all put together in one place. So I think in the next decade, if I were going to make a bet, I would say that healthcare is ready. There is a lot of people in healthcare that are talking about this. Clinical researchers are talking about this. They're feeling the pain. They're solving small pieces of this puzzle. Each person is doing it in their way. But all of this needs to come together, and we need to have almost like the CDC needs to have, if I was the king of CDC for a minute, I would bring all of this data together. I would say the VA has at least a century's worth of data. Bring that in. Bring that in and start to use it. You have all of these clinical practices around the country. Bring all of that data in. And, you know, be very, very careful and mindful of people's privacy, but still get the benefit out of it. So that's, I think, the biggest thing that can happen.
Well, the second question on the flip side, you know, the first question being, you know, how might big data have a positive impact. But on the flip side, what aspect of the world do you see as being the most threatened by big data over the next 10 years? You know, in what ways do you think big data poses some threat?
So we started the conversation talking about a three-legged stool about how you do data analysis. Bad data analysis is happening all around us all the time. This is by far more threatening than, you know, anything that can happen with good data analysis. With good data analysis, what you're doing is you're trying to find a signal in the sea of noise that is available to you in the data. With bad data analysis, you walk in with assumptions or biases that will yield really nasty results. So I'll give you an example. If you looked at the HMDA data, which is from the world of mortgages, whether or not somebody was awarded a mortgage, if you look at that data and try to figure out if somebody, if the financial institutions are systemically biased against a race or a gender, if that was the question that you were posing, you could end up with two different conclusions depending on how you pose that question against that same data.
Right.
You could, in fact, end up with many, many different conclusions depending on how you pose that question. You could find pockets in the country where this is absolutely true and it's the remnants of redlining. And then there are places in the country where this is absolutely not true and it's the exact opposite.
Right.
How do you do this responsibly? And how do you train the next round of quantitative analysts so that they are walking in with an awareness that there is a social responsibility aspect to what they do? They can't just do facial recognition and ignore the fact that people have different color skins, they have different genders. You can't ignore these things.
Yes.
You have to take these things into account. And you can't ignore the fact that your algorithms are getting trained on data that is male bias. Then when a resume shows up with a female on it, you can sort of assume, like, you can't do that. That is by far more dangerous, and it's happening. And we're unaware of it because a lot of these models don't see the light of day. Sure, the two examples that I cited are celebrated and we all know about it. But the rest of it that is happening on a day-to-day basis, we don't hear about it because it's a small thing or so-called small thing in some little corner doing some little thing. That's what scares me more than anything else. I want the next round of data analysts to be aware of the impact of what they're doing.
Thank you. That's fascinating. And I couldn't agree more. Those are very relevant points. Well, last question. Question three. Artificial intelligence, friend or foe?
Let me object to the term. How's that?
I like it.
A lot of what we call artificial intelligence today is really running regressions or fancier algorithms on larger and larger volumes of data. It is not intelligent per se because a lot of the intelligence is coming from the analysts sitting behind the keyboard.
Right. I think that's why they say it's art at the beginning of the word artificial.
Yes. So I call it automated insight. It still stays true to AI, but I try to get away from artificial intelligence. I think of intelligence as the I think it was McCarthy that said that he should have called it, instead of artificial intelligence, he could have called it cognology. That way, nobody would have cared.
That's funny.
The point is this. The point is that intelligence is the realm of philosophers and linguists and analysts of human behavior in a different way than what we do. What we do is we look at data and we try to fit the behavior of the past, basically fancy ways of curve fitting across large volumes of data, many, many dimensions. We shouldn't confuse that with intelligence. Intelligence has more legs than just fitting a curve. There is behavior that's exhibited. There is There are things such as common sense where we really don't understand. It is not about having a full repository of all human knowledge, which Google has, but that's not enough. It's the mechanism. It's the general purpose mechanism that autonomously, independently, sort of like you and I, can actually navigate that information and come to conclusions and drive subsequent decisions in areas where they have no expertise. That common sense mechanism is complex and not well understood. We are many, many, many decades away from understanding enough of that to mimic it.
I love it. Well, Afshin, thank you again for all this time. It's been great having you. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
So that was my conversation with Afshin Goodarzi of 1010 Data, an amazing man who is trafficking every day in the data that's changing our world. If you like the episode, go ahead and subscribe. We have a bunch of terrific new data-driven interviews coming your way in the next few weeks. And we'd love it if you could give us a positive review on iTunes. That's hugely helpful in giving the podcast more visibility. Thanks again for listening. I'm Greg Fisher. See you next time on The Q Factor.
Greg Fisher is founder and portfolio manager of Quent Capital, a registered investment advisor. Economic and market views and forecasts stated by Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital are current as of the date of this podcast and are subject to change without notice. This presentation is not intended to be a solicitation of any kind. It is for general informational purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results. The views of the guests that appear on the Q Factor are their own and may not reflect the views of Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital.